This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Robert Wainwright is a journalist and the author of Miss Muriel Matters, joins us on the program this morning. Hello, Robert.
Hello, thanks for having me.
What a great name.
I couldn't quite believe it when I first read it. Muriel, of course, is a wonderful Australian name, and she mattered. And a lot of people think that that's not actually her name until they read it twice. But yes, it was great.
How did you come across the story, and where did your interest come from?
Well, it started because I've written a dozen books, and my youngest daughter is a great reader, but she'd found none of them particularly interesting for her. And I decided, my theme of writing was to find lost histories, lost Australian histories. And I thought that I should find something that she would be interested in. She was 14 at the time. And her Twitter handle was Princess Against Patriarchy. And I just decided to see if I could find a lost suffragette and just began searching and stumbled across the name. And as soon as I did and read the bare minimum of what she'd done, I thought, this is the woman. Went from there.
On our Facebook site, these are two comments from women. Absolutely brilliant woman, way ahead of her peers, dropping leaflets from a balloon, one of my favourite suffragettes. And this woman was a powerhouse. So possibly lost, but definitely shouldn't have been lost by the sound of it.
No, history is a funny thing because so many times you find that we have great heroes, and this one we have the Pankhurst women, for example, and yet behind those heroes we find others who were equally stunning or important, but they tend to get lost in the shadows of others who are put up there by the media perhaps or the Times as the heroes or the heroines, and then if we do look a little bit behind, we find so many other people who are incredible, and Muriel is a great example of that.
Well, let's
in her time, you know.
Let's take a look at her, and we'll go back and take a look at her early childhood, because that influenced the woman that she became. Was she from a political family, or did she get an interest in the women's movement young?
Well, that's the other wonderful thing about this, is she witnessed both the Adelaide or South Australia granting women the right to vote and to stand for Parliament, so the first in the world to do those things, and then went to England and witnessed and was part of the suffrage movement there. And her family were actually churchgoers. So they were very powerful people in the Methodist Church, and in that time, one of the things that they aspired to was helping women. And it wasn't about voting necessarily, although that was part of it. It was because health and education was so poor, government policy didn't really cover women that much. There were women who were abused sexually, all sorts of things that they championed. And they were her family, and she watched this happen. And in fact, she, because she was an entertainer even as a child, she became involved in fundraising that the church would do through Adelaide for these various causes. So she was there. She was age 17 at the time where the vote went through in Adelaide for granting women the vote. So it was very, very much a part of her, an imprint on her childhood.
When you say that she was entertaining at the time, because she was a talented young musician.
Yeah, well, her great talent was the art of elocution, which we know through Lionel Logue, who was the King's Speech Guy, as we call him. And here is a quirk of history. Lionel Logue came from Adelaide, and he was taught elocution by the same teacher as Muriel. They were childhood friends. He was slightly younger than Muriel. But this was an Edwardian parlour entertainment, it's not just public speaking, it's this ability to throw your voice and recite great tracts of poetry, and frankly, I'd go to sleep in the first 10 minutes. But in those days, they would speak for hours and recite great poems, often to music, and that was her great gift. And in fact, that led very much to her spectacular place in the suffrage movement, because she was not only a beautiful woman and very engaging, but also had voted, which has almost made her unique in the UK, but she had an ability to keep a crowd together outside. And I found numerous examples of 2,000 or even 3,000 people gathered around her in a public square listening. And she could only do that because of her voice.
Because when I was doing the reading on her, when it talks about her being involved in music, it was actually her speaking that was the important part of that. Within that, though, when you take a look at her, then her influence and her ability to speak, was her elocution one of the things that she then passed on as well? Did she teach elocution?
Well, she taught elocution to keep herself to earn money, essentially. I mean, she didn't write about herself. She didn't hold what she'd done as terribly important or her role in it anyway. And so part of the struggle with these sorts of stories is filling in these gaps. And one of the things that people often ask is, well, how did she keep body and soul together? And she would, unusually for a woman of her time, when she needed money, she would often hang out a shingle, whether it was in Adelaide or whether it was in London, and she would teach elocution. And so she was a teacher in that sense, not to other suffragettes, but certainly as a small business to earn money, yes.
Hey, Robert, because if she was reading poetry, was the poetry that she read, especially originally, part of the things that influenced her later in life as well, the poets that she chose?
Well, Robert Browning was a great influence, and Henrik Ibsen's play was probably the most significant influence in her life. The Doll's House, which was all about a woman who left her family to seek her own identity, which, as you can imagine, in the 19th century was terribly controversial. And yes, she drew her strength and her examples from literature, and often from poetry, but also from plays.
Robert, she is recognised in Australia. What is it that took her off to London? We talk about a play about a young woman finding her identity. Is that why she went to London?
Yeah, look, she had various roles in entertainment in Australia. One was as a parlour entertainer, if you like, which was society. But she also was an actress with travelling troupes. And played on the stage, either comedic roles or dramatic roles. And she was dissatisfied with that, partly because women and stagehands in the industry were abused, a la Harvey Weinstein, that we find 100 years later. But she was seeking something more, and like others, she decided to try Europe. And others had trodden that path before. So she set off in 1905 only to seek her fortune as an actress in London. And that changed pretty quickly after she arrived.
What caused that change?
Well, she put it down to an evening of entertainment. She was invited to the house of a Russian left-wing activist named Peter Kropotkin, I probably aren't pronouncing that correctly, who was looked like he was Rasputin's cousin, frankly. And she performed for him, and she says that he just looked at her and didn't say anything. And she read in his looking at her that she was wasting her talent, and there was something more to be done with this talent, and the stage wasn't the place to do it. So she, I think that was probably a little bit dramatic as to what happened, and it was already in her mind, but certainly the response of people like that convinced her that really she was wasting this talent and could use it to greater good.
Did she actually work as an actress when she was there before this happened, or did this happen very early?
No, she did. She worked as an actress and was very successful. And in fact, she got in with the Bloomsbury clique, and one of her closest friends was a young George Bernard Shaw, believe it or not. And she actually did some work with him as a journalist later on. So she was well regarded. She had some good reviews in the Times, again, as an elocutionist, and had various roles. But it probably lasted on and off for 2 years, I suppose.
So she was there for a little while.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But she was in that time. She had been drawn into looking at the suffrage movement a few months after arriving, but gradually it was only probably 2 years later that she made the jump and decided that that was where she was going to take her life.
So was that belief that she needed to be using her talents for a greater good, was it considered to be the suffrage movement, or was it something else as well? Because she was a journalist, she wrote too.
Well, she became a journalist a little bit later. I mean, she again was involved in industrial causes. Again, this harks back to her church upbringing, I suspect. And in fact, the same thing happened. She saw young women on who were stagehands and various things in London who were being abused and used in other ways, and she tried to draw attention to that, and that led her toward the suffrage movement. I think what she saw the suffrage movement as was the vote was merely a symbol of something far greater, and she talked about that often in her life, that it was about policy, it was about inequality across the spectrum. It wasn't simply about having a vote in a parliament. And that's where she pursued it, actually.
So then how did she then work with the suffrage movement? Did she become part of a movement in itself, or what was her role?
Well, there were actually three main groups. I mean, we think of the suffrage movement as one, but it wasn't. And briefly, suffrage started in the 1860s, and for 50 years, nothing much happened, and it waxed and waned, and people and men brought some, tried to get an act through Parliament several times, and it always failed. And what happened was that Emmeline Pankhurst, who was an agitator from Manchester, decided that not enough was being done publicly, and so she formed her own group, a breakaway group from the main body. And they were the best known suffrage group and were involved later on in acts of violence. And that split again because Emmeline, for all her great qualities, was actually an autocrat. And she wasn't interested in women from the poor areas of London. She was only really interested in women who could provide money. And she was also not interested in allowing anybody else to run her organisation. And so you had a third group which broke off, and they were sort of fitted halfway between, and they saw themselves more as suffragists than suffragettes. And they were the Women's Freedom League, and that was the group that Muriel joined. So it was sort of a halfway house between those women who met and talked about things but didn't really protest in public, and the Pankhursts who were out there all the time.
So what was her role within the Women's Freedom League?
Well, she was given a role quite quickly because she made such... You know, they would meet several times a week in various halls. And so, you know, speakers... people would speak, and her voice was quickly understood to be quite special. In fact, somebody... There's another member whose name was Marion Holmes actually recorded the response to it. And if I can read this little bit out, she said, this is Marion Holmes, said that I remember how eagerly we discussed her afterwards because Muriel had made a speech in this in-house thing. Who was she? She had told us in her speech that she was an Australian. The rest we knew nothing. Then in the usual cold-blooded fashion of the members, we debated how best we could use her gifts, her enthusiasm, her eloquence, her wonderful magical voice for the cause. So they recognised very quickly that she was something unique. And what they did was that they set her off on a horse and cart to drive and trundle from village to village and town to town for 3 months through Kent and Sussex and the counties to the south of London to basically hold meetings in town squares and raise membership and create branches. And it was a membership drive to really sort of grab the attention. And it was so successful that the other groups would do the same over the next few years. And she was a target of abuse. She had police escorts because these town centre gatherings, troublemakers would come and it was quite violent. And she became famous because she would appear, this tiny figure on, you know, standing on a horse and cart, and in this membership drive. And that was the way they saw her, as just somebody who could draw people out and become interested.
But that's not only drawing people who are for her and the movement, but also those against as well.
Yeah, it was, because it was incredible the propaganda that was around at the time and fed by politicians of the day of how ugly and terrible these women were. I mean, they were painted as ugly dragons who ended families, who created schism, who could never marry. And the thing was about Muriel was, when people saw Muriel, they went, well, she doesn't look like a dragon, she doesn't sound like a dragon, she's got a brain. And if you look at some of the propaganda around that, they try to, you know, they would represent a woman's brain as only capable of thinking about certain things. And if you tried to cram politics in there, of course, you destroyed everything. So it created this sense of, we'd call it fake news, I suppose, nowadays, but this sense that these women were dangerous, and people chose to believe it. And so it was a very, very dangerous time for a lot of brave women who went out and tried to create awareness to this issue.
And did she change attitudes herself? Did she change attitudes towards not only the women's movement, but also the Freedom League in itself?
Well, she was certainly successful in increasing the membership size and understanding, absolutely. I mean, it's hard to quantify what hers was, but all the evidence was that they saw this three-month stint as its most successful membership drive. And, I mean, she came back a hero to the movement. And also, the important thing for them was that the media started to take interest again, and they took interest in this woman who was very different. And they called them stunts, and they were very clever at some of these stunts to create attention. And the next one that they used her in was probably the most famous protest of any suffrage protest, which was in late 1908. She became the first woman to make a speech in the House of Commons. And she was a protester. What the group wanted to do was draw attention to the fact that women who went into the House as spectators were forced to sit in a cramped room in the ceiling of Parliament House behind a brass grill that you would expect to find in a mosque more than anything else. And it shielded them visually from the men below. And it had been this way forever, and there had been attempts to remove this grill, and nothing had ever happened. And so they created this protest on the night where some diversionary protests were created outside to draw security forces. And at the stroke of 8:30, Muriel, who was sitting in this gallery, rushed forward and chained herself to one of the panels of the grill. And she had two padlocks. And then began making a speech, and the men below were shocked because a woman's voice had never been heard in the House of Commons before. And she made this speech, which was about attend to the women's movement. You're talking about boring things. In fact, I've got some of her words here. She called out, "Mr. Speaker, members of the illiberal government, we have sat behind this insulting grill for too long. It is time you cease to legislate merely on effects. It behoves you to deal with primary causes. You are discussing a domestic question, and it's time that the women of England were given the vote in legislation which affects them as much as affects men. We demand the vote. We have listened far too long to the illogical utterances of men who know nothing about it. Attend to the women." And it created a huge uproar below, because not only was this female voice heard, but what she was telling them, there were dunderheads. And they rushed to grab her and force her off, but of course she was chained to this grill, and they couldn't find the padlock and they couldn't unlock her. And eventually they had to bring in some blacksmiths and cut the grill off and carry her away. And the next day the London Illustrated News carried this wonderful illustration of Muriel with this grill being removed, and it was what they wanted. The grill had been taken down. And for that, forevermore in London, she was known as the Lady of the Grill.
Was it taken down as a result?
Yes, it was. It was taken down. It was, and the panels, the funny thing is that, in fact, the House of Commons doesn't exist anymore because it was bombed during the Second World War. They rebuilt it. And the only thing that remains of that original House of Commons are those panels, because they were put in storage in the bowels of Westminster, Palace of Westminster. And then some years later brought up, and they're used as decoration in a central hall. So you can actually see the panels, although not in situ, they're just used as decorations. And I think one of the panels of the grill is actually in South Australia now, and another one is in the London Museum, along with the chain that Muriel used on that day to chain herself with a great leather belt to this grill. So it was a stunning success. She was really annoyed that she wasn't arrested at the time. They just threw her out. And so she rushed around and joined the other protests and intent on being arrested, and was, and then along with others, was thrown into prison for a month. So she was one of the hundreds of women over this protest who served time in Holloway Prison as well.
On the texting service and also via our Facebook site, Robert, there is mention of the balloon flight. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I can. If I can just tell you this one thing that I've just found, which gives us a sense of how difficult it was. This is what the Attorney General of the United Kingdom, Sir William Robson, said after Muriel's protest in the House of Parliament. He said, in order to keep those unsexed hyenas in petticoats from disturbing the deliberations of the most majestic assembly in the world, we propose to pack them to police court. The very rest word they utter, and they'll be sentenced there for at least 6 months. Then he spoke about Muriel. For this House to be interrupted in the discussions of high matters of state by persons who are not persons, who have no country, no rights, and yet are harboured and permitted to exist in the land of the free, only confirms my former opinion that females are something less than human, and herein lies our difficulty. That's the Attorney General of the day.
Is it, as you go back to what your daughter wanted, what she wanted to hear a story about, it fits in really nicely, doesn't it?
It does. But, yeah, it does. The balloon, or it's actually a dirigible or an airship, depending on which way you speak about it, was incredible because at the very time that she took this flight over London, the Wright brothers were testing the aircraft in Paris. So this is at the very beginning of powered flight, within a few years of it. And until that time, there were balloon flights where tethered balloons would go up in grounds and people would take a ride above and then be pulled back down. But powered flight was almost non-existent. And in fact, when Muriel was in this airship, people ran from her. She recalled people running from her in fear because they'd never seen anything like this before. But the background was that the king or queen now, but the king in the day, would open Parliament in great pomp and ceremony and come from Buckingham Palace in a golden carriage and come down the Mall. And the Women's Freedom League wanted to hand out leaflets how to vote or vote for women. And the police said, if you do, we're going to arrest you. So they decided, well, if we can't hand out in the street, we'll simply go above their heads, which was a wonderful thought. And they immediately decided that Muriel was the person who could do this because she was crazy enough to do it, but she had this wonderful voice and this, you know, she could speak through a megaphone. And the idea was that they would try to drift down over the top of Parliament or over the carriage and basically drop the leaflets over the head of the king, which was a fantastic in theory. The problem was, of course, with flight in those days, it was so limited that being able to steer these any airship was rather difficult with any wind. So they identified a site which would become one of London's major wartime airports to the north of the city and tried to judge the wind so it would essentially drift down from the north and try to time with the king passing. And they didn't quite manage to do what they wanted, partly because they were delayed because the engine wouldn't start. But they managed to get airborne, and essentially this thing was built of bamboo and with a tiny basket, and she was in there with one other man. And they managed to drift down over the city and pass within sight of Parliament House, dropping leaflets as they went, and ended up sailing down south of London and landing in a tree in a dairy farm. But they did what they wanted to do, and they created enough of publicity about this event that it was recognised by the New York Times as the world's first aerial protest, and it was front page news. So it was a remarkably successful and amazingly brave thing to do, I think.
Dean joined us. Hello, Dean.
Trevor, a couple of months ago, I'm just curious about this grill that Muriel chained her hands to. A couple of months ago, did you highlight another Australian woman in the Australian suffragette who went to England and glued her hands to the very same grill?
Look, it rings a bell, but I can't remember who it was or what the circumstance was or whether or not it was the Grills of Parliament.
Yeah, I just seem to remember, I can't remember the person's name either. I just thought I'd ask.
Are you aware of that, Robert?
No, not to these grills. I mean, I think that a number of suffragettes and possibly quite a few Australians were involved in protests where they chained themselves to fences, certainly in Downing Street and certainly around that time. And in fact, the idea to chain herself to the grill came from one of the early protests with fences. But specifically to inside Parliament, that was the only one.
Yeah,
it could never happen again.
And I think it was to a fence outside, and I can't remember the story, but you're right, Dean, there was. And it was. Was this something that was happening, Robert? Were there a lot of Australian women in England as well at the same time?
There weren't a lot, but they were significant. The ones who went were quite significant, and they all played a role. I think there's a book that's just come out by Claire Wright, which details what the Australians were doing, and they were, I mean, there was a massive protest. There was a protest in Hyde Park that had 500,000 people at it, and Australians were front and centre in that. In fact, the wife of the Prime Minister at the time was heavily involved. So, yes, there were, you know, Muriel certainly wasn't the only one. She was certainly probably the most prominent, but there were other women who were there and playing a role as well.
Did she come back to Australia then? Because I know she did lecture tours in Australia. What was the purpose of that?
Well, simply to highlight those causes. I mean, in fact, and this is where she broadened, because she became interested in prison reform because of the months she spent behind bars, and she could see the futility of locking people up with nothing else, just starved them. And that was one of the things that she championed for throughout the rest of her life. She was, even though Australia had, women had the vote, that was merely the beginning in terms of what they wanted, because they wanted this to lead to representatives in Parliament, and Australia didn't really follow through with that for some time. And they also wanted policy development that was domestic policy about households and about also rights for children. There was, you know, children were being abused from the young. When I say abused, I mean taken advantage of from a very young age. Muriel was also involved in the establishment of the first juvenile court, so the recognition that children should be treated differently in justice in courts than adults, because they were children, which seems logical now but wasn't then. So her tour was about what, and she told her stories. But the intent of what she was saying was okay, now this is, we've got this, now we need to take it and make use of it. And she was very successful.
When within that, the suffragette movement at that time, because you've mentioned how it separated into three movements, did they also work together?
They were rivals, really. They were, yes, they were frenemies. How about that? That's a way to talk about it. I mean, the oldest one was, they really looked at the other two and thought that they were doing the wrong thing, because they wanted to sit back, and they'd been told, all you have to do is be quiet and be patient and we'll give you what you want. Of course, they never did. As they got more frustrated because politicians made more promises and didn't come through with them, the Pankhurst group became more violent or it was more unwieldy. And so they were looked upon by Muriel's mob as being far too ideologically driven. So, yes, they did work together. They came together on occasions, but they represented different factions. And as we know, factions don't always work well together.
Was there support from men as well for what they were trying to do at that time?
Yeah, there was plenty of support. There was many of the women took their husband. The husbands of some of these women took the women's names. I mean, they hyphenated their surnames. So that started a movement that would grow, I suppose, over the years. But there were specific men's movement there to support suffrage. Also, bear in mind that at the time it was only probably 40% of men had the vote. So it was really held within an elite group of people. And probably the truth is that women only got the vote in Britain because of the drive after the Great War to give men who had died or who had put their lives on the front were given the vote. And as part of all this sort of change in policy, women were also added. But you had to have a certain level of education or income before you were considered intelligent enough to vote.
It was a difficult time during the Great War, during the First World War, for so many people in England. What was her role, or what were her views, what was happening around the First World War?
Well, the women's movement sort of collapsed during the Great War. They all agreed to stop protesting, and in fact, they then were involved in different things depending on which ideal where they were driven from. Muriel became a pacifist, and she was significant in early creation of international groups, I suppose. In fact, she attended the world's first meeting of these pacifist groups in Belgium during the war, and was only able to attend because she had an American passport, because the British wouldn't let their women out. But that was one of her roles. But she also became heavily involved in working in the slums of London, in Southwark specifically, which was housing owned by the Duke of Cornwall, that's owned by the Prince of the Prince of Wales. And the housing was appalling. And so she ran campaigns to improve housing. She ran workshops on health for women, on education for women, and worked, in fact, funnily enough, with Miles Franklin, who later became the our great author. They were great friends. And she also worked with Emily Pankhurst as well in the east of London, in the slums there, and began early childhood education with Montessori. So she spread herself a lot more thinly with a lot more greater causes in society.
When you take a look at it, I mean, she was involved in so many things. It's amazing we don't hear more of it, but that's why you've written the book. She goes back to Australia to do a second tour, which was mainly on Montessori. Why didn't she come back to Australia to live?
Well, she found her calling. I mean, she had left Australia because there wasn't anything for her. I mean, obviously, she was frustrated by what she could achieve as an actress there, and so she went seeking a life that meant something, and she found a greater cause. So that was where her life was. You can't. I mean, I've written about another man who went to climb Mount Everest. I mean, you can't stay in Australia and climb Mount Everest. So, not in those days.
I just wonder, given that Australia had the vote, that why she wouldn't come back here and see that she would have a role in politics. When you take a look at her beliefs and what she is wanting to do, and her support for women and for children, that there's a role in politics.
Well, she did have a role in politics, and in fact, she stood for the seat of Hastings here in the UK, and she wasn't successful. She didn't expect to be successful, because it would take some time to change society's opinion and elect a woman to the House of Commons. But she did play roles with those. She became an ambassador, particularly for childhood education. And that was where the centre of it was, Europe. So she didn't see... I mean, she always saw herself as Australian, but she saw herself as a woman who could play a role in where she was needed, and where she felt she was needed was clearly in the UK. She also got married to a man here and clearly had a married life as well.
Well, let's go back to that being the candidate for Hastings. How did that come about?
Well, she was great friends with the first Labor Prime Minister of Great Britain, who was Ramsay MacDonald, and he wanted women to stand, and in fact, they had identified a seat they thought she could win, but she wasn't really interested. This was in 1924. And then she was, in 1919, I think. But then she was convinced to stand, but she wasn't interested in standing in a seat that was a potential winner. She wanted to stand in a place where she could make a protest against the worst she saw of society, and she saw that Hastings was the place that she needed to stand, because a man named Lord Eustace Percy, who was the Baron of Newcastle, was the elected representative, and he never went there. And so she decided to make a protest, and out of losing. and that was her form of activism.
How was she perceived or supported by other men in politics? Was there, through her work, was there a recognition that we started to have to look closely at what's happening with women and with children?
Well, I think that was wouldn't be put down to Muriel. I mean, there are many figures who that would be true of. I mean, she stepped off the stage of activism directly on voting issues back in 1912. She actually found that she didn't like the violence that was happening, and she wanted to broaden her activism into areas of policy, hence why she went to Southwark. But I don't think you can put that down to one person, rather through a group of people. But she was certainly recognised and sought out by politicians of the day, such as Ramsay MacDonald, to play a role. And she would have played a great scene, a role behind the scenes as well.
When you take a look at her achievements, what are the things that you think are the most important things to highlight after such an incredible life?
Well, I was astounded that I knew that there was a great story in the things that she did that created publicity, and as I was trying to research and write this, I knew that she left the movement in 1912, and I wondered what story was I going to tell after that. And what I found was the story that I told after that, to me, was the most important achievement of Muriel, which was that she didn't need the spotlight. She didn't need the crowds in front of her who were roaring her name or calling out cooey as they used to. Her sincerity was such that she wanted to get in and get her hands dirty and play a role at ground level in changing things and helping people. And this was in, as I say, in the slums of Southwark or in championing childhood education, which she recognised as a terribly important thing. She was involved in helping to design the first central heating for public housing in Europe, which remains now the same place. It was built in Glasgow. She was involved in animal rights. So it was the ground level stuff that she did, which I think makes her particularly special, even though we see that the highlights, which are, you know, the flight over London, the caravan tour, and the protest in Parliament House.
Did your daughter enjoy the book?
Well, she did, yeah. She's now read two others I've written as well. So she decided that lost histories are quite interesting after all.
Robert, it's a fascinating story. And tell us, Jed, thank you for telling us just a little bit about her life as well. For listeners who are interested in finding out more, Robert's book is called Miss Muriel Matters. Robert, thank you very much for joining us on the program this morning.
Thanks, Trevor. Thanks very much.
Robert Wainwright, the journalist and author of Miss Muriel Matters. You're listening to Overnights on ABC Radio.